elected are Richard John Claude Kine.
Thank you. And counsel, welcome to the Court of Appeals. We will happy to be here with all of you in Rochester. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your arguments. Counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There's a clock that you can keep track of your time that will help. When you come to the podium, would you please introduce yourself? Because we are recording this, and that way it'll be clear from our records who's saying what. So counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning, Your Honors. Morgan Carlson on behalf of Appellant Gary Kine. May it please the court, counsel, the primary issue here is ensuring a correct and just outcome in an important probate matter. The parties agree the appropriate standard of review for the denial of an evidentiary hearing is an abuse of discretion standard. This court may find an abuse of discretion when it finds the district court's ruling was based on an erroneous view of the law, or when its decision is against the facts and the record. The appellant asserts that both are true here. When this appeal concerns whether the district court abused its discretion when it denied appellant's motion on the court's opinions formed during a previous hearing on an entirely different piece of evidence with entirely different burdens of proof, appellant believes the district court's decision to deny the requested relief was an abuse of discretion. The procedural posture of this matter began with competing petitions for the probate of decedent Richard Kine's estate. Appellant Gary Kine, the decedent's brother, located a copy of the decedent's will in a lockbox located inside a dumpster on decedent's property. It is assumed that Michael Kine, the decedent's son, was cleaning out his property and threw it into the dumpster. Appellant submitted the will copy with his petition, and Michael Kine alleged that there was no will available. After an evidentiary hearing, the district court issued an order on June 20, 2018, determining the document dated October 14, 2014 is lost, revoked, and not valid.
After the counsel, I think we're pretty familiar with the procedural backdrop of this case. If I could ask you to go back to something you started with, and you said that there were two reasons you thought this was an abuse of discretion, and the first was that the court's decision was based on an erroneous view of the law. From your perspective, what was the erroneous view of the law the district court had when the court denied the motion for an evidentiary hearing?
Certainly, Your Honor. There are essentially two different burdens if the will proponent is offering a copy of the will versus if the will proponent is offering an original will. The burden for an original will would be a prima facie showing of due execution in all cases, whereas the burden if you're offering a copy is to overcome the presumption that if you only have a copy, it was lost and therefore revoked.
But aren't you getting a little ahead of yourself with that analysis? Because isn't the issue here just whether or not to have the evidentiary hearing?
I don't believe it's getting ahead of myself, Your Honor, because the district court based its decision on the June 20, 2018 hearing, which only had a will copy and not the original will. Whereas with the motion to vacate, appellant was offering an original will with a different burden of proof.
The way I read the district court decision, so let me know if you disagree with this, is the district court based its decision on the credibility assessments it made in that hearing regarding the witnesses, who also were witnesses who provided the affidavits with the motion.
That was part of the basis, Your Honor, and in fact, I believe there weren't any credibility determinations in the court's June 20, 2018 order. There were three witnesses offered by the now appellant. That was Gary Kine himself. And with its memorandum, the court stated Gary Kine was not forthcoming about his criminal history. The other two witnesses were William and Kay Kine, husband and wife, the witnesses to both the copy of the will and the original will.
I read what the district court was saying about the three witnesses you just referred to as implicitly, at least, making credibility assessments, especially when remarking upon your clients not being forthcoming. Would you disagree with that?
I agree that there is a credibility finding, at least as it relates to Gary Kine, but not as it relates to William or Kay Kine. And in paragraph 5 of its findings of fact from the December 14, 2018 order, the court specifically stated it relies on the legal and credibility determinations of the June 20, 2018 order. The legal determinations were only based upon the presumption that a lost will is deemed revoked. So it's setting a higher standard for an original will and is therefore an error of law. In his motion, the appellant first requested vacation of that June 20, 2018 order pursuant to Rule 60.02 or under Minnesota Statute Sections 524.3-413 and 524.1-304. In his second request for relief, appellant requested that the probate of decedent Richard Keim's handwritten October 14, 2014 will, or in the alternative, permission to file a petition for formal probate, or in the alternative, a new evidentiary hearing to hear the newly discovered evidence.
So, counsel, that was the basis, right, for your motion to vacate and request was the newly discovered evidence? I mean,
yes.
That's your legal argument, right?
That was the basis for the first request for relief. The second request for relief could come back to Minnesota statute, which states if a will is found after a petition has already been heard and decided and a personal representative has already been appointed, the court shall entertain a petition for a formal probate of that new will, so long as it was discovered after the first hearing had already taken place.
All right. And I want to start just talk about the newly discovered evidence piece. I see that it didn't play a prominent role in the district court's analysis, but I'm trying to understand what your argument is. And let me just try to explain it sort of simply. In looking at a motion to vacate, a district court has to, you know, assess what grounds the motion is being raised, and one of them is newly discovered evidence. So I guess I'm struggling to see how this is newly discovered evidence. It's a document found inside the same lockbox. The affidavit explanations for why it's new seem to me to be pretty thin because it is a lockbox. It's a legal pad that was present in the lockbox. The text of the handwritten document appears to be the same. Suddenly we have witnesses offering affidavits that are different from the sworn testimony that they gave at the trial. So maybe you can help clarify that for me.
Yes, Your Honor.
It doesn't sound like newly discovered evidence. It sounds like evidence that was well available to your client at the time of the evidentiary hearing.
We were terming it newly discovered evidence due to the likelihood of finding a will in...
But is there any basis in the law for viewing it that way? That is the likelihood of finding the evidence when, in fact, you had the lockbox?
It comes down to whether he should have found it before the hearing. And part of whether you should find something is whether it's reasonable to look in a particular location for it. Within the lockbox, I would say, yes, it's reasonable to look for it within the lockbox. But the appellant believed that the legal pad was sitting at the bottom to essentially...
What, under some keys? And that's why he didn't see it?
Yes, Your Honor, that's what the appellant has stated.
I mean, you know, again, I'm reading a bit between the lines in the district court's analysis. The district court clearly does make a determination, you know, a piggybacking perhaps on the earlier impressions of the court during the evidentiary hearing, you know, which I want to underscore. Your client did get an evidentiary hearing. It just didn't happen with regard to this second, you know, document. But based on that initial evidentiary hearing, the district court did make some credibility determinations and implicitly, you know, made some additional credibility determinations based on the affidavit evidence.
I would argue that the district court didn't make credibility determinations as it comes to William and Kay Keim. It may be read into the document,
I suppose. Honestly, that's maybe even harder for me to understand. How could they have stood up and testified about having witnessed this typewritten will and yet failed to mention that, oh, by the way, there was a handwritten will as well? I mean, I am not sitting here as the trier of fact. That's not my role. That already happened. The district court did that. We are a reviewing court in which we're going to defer to a credibility determination by the district court. So.
I understand, Your Honor. The reason that I am aware of for William and Kay Keim not testifying to the handwritten document was that they were never asked about it. They were new to the courtroom, nervous, and were informed that they should only answer the questions that they are directly asked.
And whose witnesses were they?
They were the appellant, Gary Keim's witnesses. Mm-hmm. They were also the witnesses to both wills. Didn't have a very close relationship with either the decedent or Gary Keim, so were fairly independent witnesses. I believe the main problem comes down to the district court effectively holding Gary Kime to a higher standard with an original will than he should have been held to. With an original will, it's a prima facie case of due execution. And due execution would be it's a written document signed by the decedent and signed by two witnesses. And all of these elements are within the face of that document.
When we look at the issue before us, which I believe you framed up as whether or not the district court abuses discretion by not having an evidentiary hearing, I've stated the issue correctly, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. There's also a whether the court abused its discretion in failing to allow a petition for the formal probate of the decedent's handwritten will. There is Minnesota State Statute 524.3-412. That states the court shall entertain a petition for modification.
I'm sorry. I'm just looking at your statement of the case and says, did the district court err in denying appellant an evidentiary hearing on the newly introduced evidence? I mean, that's the way you framed this.
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't that the issue before us?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So with that issue before us, why do we need to look beyond really rule 60.02, which talks about this newly discovered evidence, which doesn't require an evidentiary hearing, and Rule 43.05 of the Rules of Civil Procedure, which says that courts may hear matters on affidavits presented by respective parties. Why do we need to look further than that, which would say the court could do just what it did and rely upon the affidavits?
I don't believe this court needs to look beyond Rule 60.02 because I believe the district court did abuse its discretion in denying the request for an evidentiary hearing. Because the credibility determinations, well, first, they weren't in the record. It was implicit, and they are two very different burdens between a will copy, which was the initial evidentiary hearing, and the original will, which was offered and asked the court also for leave to petition the court for full.
Counsel, I guess I'm asking a different question. Even if the court hadn't had the previous hearings, it seems to me, looking at Rule 43.05, that the court could rely upon the affidavits before it, which were before it on the motion to vacate. So I just would like your perspective on that.
Yes, Your Honor. Under Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 43.05, it does, in effect, say that the court can rely upon the affidavits. However, in the case cited by the respondent, Soterini versus Soterini, it references prior holdings of the appellate court and the Supreme Court that Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 43.05 does not permit the district court to decide any motion or just any motion upon an affidavit.
Well, aren't those – there's some areas of the law. I'm thinking of some areas in family law perspective, for instance, where the law clearly requires an evidentiary hearing. And my reading of some of those cases is, well, those were areas where it said that evidentiary hearings are presumed or sometimes required, as opposed to this case where, point me to it if I'm wrong, there's no requirement of an evidentiary hearing in this matter.
There is no requirement of an evidentiary hearing, and when there isn't a requirement of an evidentiary hearing, or when there's a presumption against an evidentiary hearing, as in many family law cases, the court will typically review it upon a summary judgment standard, whether there is good cause to ask for an evidentiary hearing and obtain one by viewing it, whether there's any genuine issue of material.
Point me to a case that says we should be looking at a summary judgment standard, where we look at whether there's material disputed facts to decide whether or not to have an evidentiary hearing on a Rule 60 motion.
It was not directly related to a Rule 60 motion. Unfortunately, there hasn't been many appeals due to the difficulty of appealing a Rule 60 motion. However, Thompson versus Thompson, which is again cited by respondent, holds that the comparison with the Rule 60.02 motion made by respondent to a family law motion is that An evidentiary hearing isn't presumed or required in most family law cases.
But wasn't Thompson versus Thompson, as you mentioned, it's a family law case under a different statute, not under Rule 60. It was not a Rule 60 motion to vacate under 60.02.
Correct. It was not under Rule 60.02, but it's analyzing a similar situation in which an evidentiary hearing is either not required or presumed to not be needed.
I thought that case said that there was, the district court had great discretion in making that decision, didn't it?
The court did have great discretion, but in reviewing the district court's decision to deny an evidentiary hearing, the Thompson versus Thompson said this Supreme Court has historically reviewed that under a summary judgment standard, essentially stating, I see a lot of time.
You can go ahead and answer the question, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Essentially stating that when an evidentiary hearing isn't necessarily required, the standard is more of a good cause, and the good cause standard is interpreted under a summary judgment standard.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. Respondent is obviously in opposition to this appeal.
Counsel, if you would start by introducing yourself.
Anthony Moosbrugger on behalf of respondent Michael Keim. Appellant is arguing here that the district court erred in denying appellant's motion to vacate without holding an evidentiary hearing. But first, there's the issue of did the appellant actually request an evidentiary hearing? We would contend the appellant did not even request an evidentiary hearing. In their motion itself, they relied on their affidavits. Central to that issue of whether or not they requested an evidentiary hearing is the fact that appellant did not provide the appellate court the transcript. The appellant does bear the burden of providing an adequate record on appeal. Holding in Mitterhauser v. Mitterhauser, 399 Northwest 2nd, 664, Minnesota Court of Appeals, 1987. So without a transcript, the appellant is asking the Court of Appeals to presume there was an error. And as was held in Custom Farm Services, Inc., error cannot be presumed. Custom Farm Services, Inc. v. Collins, 338 Northwest 2nd, 608, Minnesota Supreme Court, 1976.
Counsel, can I go back to your point about the transcript? Did you, and I may have misstated, and you certainly know your brief better than I do, did you make that argument? I noted your argument that the request for an evidentiary hearing was not requested at the district court. Did you also make the argument in your brief about the transcript?
These, no, the cases I'm just citing are not in my brief.
And just for a clarification, you mean a transcript of the previous evidentiary hearing?
Well, really a transcript of either hearing. There's no transcript of the motion hearing or the evidentiary hearing except for an excerpt.
And I'm familiar with the case law you're citing in terms of that burden falls to the appellant and that it can hamper this court's review. But I guess I'm struggling to see how it hampers this court's review in this case.
Well, because the respondent's contention is that there was no request for an evidentiary hearing.
Okay, so
and that
would have
been set forth
request.
In that okay. transcript,
Got it.
The
okay.
correspond or the arguments between by counsel.
Okay. Well, counsel, on that note, what about the sentence in the memorandum of law which said, alternatively, Gary Keim requested this court set a time for a new evidentiary hearing such that the parties may present all material evidence now available to them. Why isn't that a request for evidentiary hearing?
I'm sorry, where was that?
I believe
on
it's
mine?
In his memorandum of law in support of his Rule 60.02 motion. Alternatively, Gary Keim requested this court set a time for a new evidentiary hearing.
At the hearing itself, no. and
in the memorandum. I think it's in the addendum, maybe, at page 16. Let's see.
I mean, essentially, your argument is that they didn't comply with the formality of requesting a motion. They may have argued it in their supporting memorandum. Isn't that what you're arguing, that the formality was not there?
Well, I think it's more than formality, but sure. In their motion, it was, you know, if we're relying on our affidavits, but if the court would want to have an evidentiary hearing, they can have one if respondent requests one. But again, at the hearing, it was the same story. We don't need an evidentiary hearing. We're relying on our affidavits. If respondent wants to ask for an evidentiary hearing, they can. So that's the problem. They truly didn't want an evidentiary hearing at that point, from our perspective. But we don't know that because we don't have a transcript.
I see how you're tying this together, so thank you for answering my questions.
Also of issue with this lack of transcript is this the issue of the credibility determinations. In Mitterhauser, the court held that where there is no evidence in the record which contradicts the trial court's findings, the trial court must be affirmed. And we have that situation here where, again, we don't have this transcript. Potentially there'd be evidence in that from that hearing that would contradict the findings or support the findings. But without that transcript, the court, your honors, cannot make that determination. And as held in Mitterhauser, the district court then must be affirmed.
And counsel, just so I'm clear, I don't hear your opponent as arguing that we should question or even review the credibility determinations that were made following the evidentiary hearing. Instead, the argument I hear is that the district court abused its discretion in not going to an evidentiary hearing for the motion to vacate because fresh credibility questions arose. So if you'd address that point.
Well, fresh credibility.
Because now there's an original will. It appears to be an original will, and that just raises whole different issues than does a photocopy of a typed document based on Minnesota law and how we review wills of those two sorts.
Right, but I think the court made credibility determinations multiple information. So the evidentiary hearing, and the affidavits that were submitted by both parties in this motion, this Rule 60 motion for a new hearing to vacate that order. There was new information provided to the court, new affidavits provided to the court by all the old witnesses. And I would argue that in that first hearing, by that first June 2018 order, the court had made credibility determinations based on all three witnesses. And when these witnesses are then changing their story in their affidavits, the judge is again making credibility determinations for purposes of whether or not it's appropriate to vacate that order. The central issue, you know, is whether or not the decedent had a valid will. After that evidentiary hearing on April 6th, that's what the court determined that the decedent didn't have a valid will. Now, appellant wishes to offer new evidence, vacate that order, purporting that there is this new original will. Although the district court can do that, does have the discretion to vacate that order, have a new hearing, there are some burdens that the respondent or the appellant needs to meet. And they certainly haven't. First, the appellant must establish that he could have found with reasonable diligence this new evidence prior to the hearing. Secondly, he's got to show that this new evidence is not merely collateral, impeaching, cumulative, but would rather change the actual outcome of that new hearing. And those determinations are within the trial court's discretion.
Well, if I may interject here, I believe you're going to the ultimate issue as well. And isn't the issue before us simply whether or not there should have been an evidentiary hearing?
Yes, but...
So we don't need to reach the issue of whether there was due diligence here, correct?
No, I do believe we do need to reach the issue of whether there's due diligence, because whether or not there was going to be a hearing was based on whether or not the appellant acted diligently in finding that new evidence. I mean, if the hearing is going to be based on new evidence, the new evidence has to be admissible.
Well, it has to be credible.
Credible.
Credible first, which is what the district court found.
Right.
I'm throwing you support for your argument. I mean, you're not arguing that we would go back and determine the validity of the original court order that said that there was an intestate proceeding. But what you're saying is the district court was correct in determining there was no credible evidence, therefore no reason to have a hearing.
Correct.
And for your client, that would be end of story.
Right. And I guess that's where I'm kind of going with this, as far as at that first hearing and throughout, the court made credibility determinations on all three witnesses. After the first hearing, the court was then also presented with more evidence from those same three witnesses through affidavit testimony. So it follows that the court had the discretion to rule on this issue of whether to have a hearing based on credibility issues. The court had already found all three not credible. They are now coming up with new stories. If anything, it supports the judge in saying, these folks are not credible.
But all we decide is whether the judge in this case has a hearing and makes those determinations, or whether she was within her ability to make that decision based on paper. I mean, that's what the issue is. Should there have been live sworn testimony on these new claims, or could the judge do it just based on paper submissions? That's really the gist of the argument, isn't it? And you are saying paper is enough.
I'm saying paper is enough. And I guess, you know, whether or not, I mean, what the reasoning of the judge was maybe isn't relevant. To me, I guess it's relevant from the perspective of just the court, the case law supports that the court does have discretion to do that based on affidavits.
So if there's an affidavit that says, I get a new hearing because the sun is really purple, and the judge says no hearing because obvious the sun is not purple, that's good enough. That's your position, isn't it?
I'm sorry, but I guess I didn't follow.
Oh, my goodness. I'm not trying to argue with you, counsel. I'm trying to frame up the issue for both of you, because it seems to have that you've taken a wide detour, both of you have, in your argument as well as your briefing. The issue before us is whether or not the judge should have actually had the time set aside to have people sworn, take the stand, and they'd say, oh, yeah, I did find this. I didn't know it was there. There it was underneath the keys. Or whether the judge could look at the affidavit, the written statement that made such a claim, and decided whether or not that was true. You know, can a judge actually expedite a decision by ruling off of affidavits? Or does a judge, in this instance in particular, have to have a hearing? Isn't that what the issue is?
It is. And there's simply no support. And I'm sorry, I'm not going to get this thing put back together, but...
You're going to get a bill for that, by the way.
There's no support to say that the court has, or the district court has to hold an evidentiary hearing. The
What about the Thompson case that counsel for appellant cited, which is, if she's right, cited in your brief? There, the court says, look, you have an evidentiary hearing if there's good cause for a hearing, and good cause, we're going to use a summary judgment standard. The summary judgment standard often would say, well, there's sworn testimony on one side and the other, it's a material issue of fact, we have a hearing. And if we need to add a little to your time so that you can deal with this podium issue, just let us know.
Okay. No, but the all I can say, I imagine, is the case is cited here. Support the court's, what the court did here. I mean, if we even get to that point, but that the court can make these determinations just on affidavit. But I think it is a good point here that the appellant did not, essentially waived their affidavit, their request for an evidentiary hearing. They said, we are relying on our affidavits. It's right in their motion.
Why don't you take a few sentences or to wrap up? Because I know it did interfere with your presentation when you had the podium collapse. So if there's some final comments you want to make.
I did just want to, I guess, address the only, I think, case that appellant cited, or maybe line of cases the appellant cited regarding the issue of a necessity to have an evidentiary hearing. And they were all, they're all habeas corpus proceedings. And habeas corpus proceedings are unique proceedings. And I think the court's whole or rulings, how they ruled in those cases, kind of points that out. Appellant had cited the Seifert v. Erickson case. And in that case, you know, the Court of Appeals is saying petitioner referencing specifically a petition for a writ of habeas corpus when they're saying that a petitioner is entitled to an evidentiary hearing if there are facts in dispute. And the Seifert case is citing State v. Tahasha, 149 Northwest 2nd, 276, or 12 rather. And the same, it's the same scenario there. Habeas corpus proceedings are special, or that the court was even more specific in that case, stating that in a petition for habeas corpus, a petitioner is entitled to an evidentiary hearing. But it's just a separate type of proceeding that I don't believe is applicable to what we're doing here today.
Thank you very much. Any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Let's just
go from bench to sitting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think she needs to use that. Okay.
If it's easier for you just to remain seated, counsel, and do the argument, that's fine, or to stand over there, whatever works best for you. I apologize for the faulty equipment.
Oh, no, that's fine. I can see how it would. It was a little bit startling, but we'll be great. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. You may proceed.
All right. First, I'd like to start with whether the appellant had requested an evidentiary hearing, and appellant did in his motion. Paragraph 3 of the motion in full states, for formal probate of decedent Richard Kimes, October 14, 2014 will, and formal appointment of personal representative, or in the alternative, for the court's permission to file a petition for formal probate of will and for formal appointment of personal representative, or in the alternative, for a new evidentiary hearing to hear the newly discovered evidence. So the appellant did, in fact, request a new evidentiary hearing. As far as the transcript, I believe my now former counsel, co-counsel, believed that it wasn't necessary to order the transcript and sent a letter to opposing counsel stating the same, stating that he believed the paper record following was sufficient to handle the appeal. Part of Well, a big portion of what we are claiming in that the district court should have ordered an evidentiary hearing is based on the district court's findings in the December 14, 2018 order rather than necessarily what happened at the hearing. Since the findings relied upon the June 20, 2018 order, we believe that was an abuse of discretion. Appellant isn't relying on what happened at the motion hearing to state that he had requested an evidentiary hearing because it was in the motion itself. And I believe the opposing counsel also mentioned that the transcript of the motion hearing would support or may support the findings made in the order, but the findings in the order didn't refer to what happened at the hearing. It referred to the documents that were submitted, the procedural posture, and the June 20, 2018 order, all of which is in the record. I believe this case does come down to the fact that there are fresh credibility issues of these three witnesses. Even if the court had made credibility determinations previously at the prior hearing, it was under a different standard. And I do not believe the witnesses changed their story. Rather, they added additional details to it. They may have been flustered at the time. And finally, opposing counsel went to the things that would have been in the court's discretion to make findings on, such as whether there was due diligence involved. And frankly, if the district court had made that finding, I think we would be having a much harder case here at the appellate level, and I'm not sure that we would have made this appeal if there were findings on the record that supported denying the motion to vacate. And when it comes to the case law that was cited by my co-counsel, it comes down to the lack of Rule 60.02 appellate cases due to the difficulty in appealing such a case. So in conclusion, I guess the appellant is asking that this be remanded back to the district court with an order for an evidentiary hearing.
Anything else? Thank you very much. Thank you for the briefing and the argument. The matter is taken under advisement and an opinion will be issued within 90 days. Thank you both.
Thank you, Your Honor.
She's emailed somebody.
Okay. Is someone going to come up on that?
Yeah.
Okay.
She's coming.
Great.
Thank you.
So give us just a moment to those of you coming forward for the next matter. We are trying to rectify some podium issues here.
That's satisfactory.
I thought I had some cards.